This is The Visible Hand. My name is Jordi Blanes y Vidal. My guest today is Marta Serra García, who is an associate professor of economics and strategy at Rady School of Management, University of California, San Diego. Today we're going to talk about her paper, Enabling or Limiting Cognitive Flexibility, Evidence of Demand for Moral Commitment, which is joined with Silvia Sacardo. The paper was published in the American Economic Review in 2023. Marta, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Marta, what is belief distortion?
Belief distortion is when your beliefs deviate from what we would consider the Bayesian benchmark, or they do not display movements or comparative statics that are aligned with our traditional framework, which is the Bayesian updating framework. That's how we think about belief distortion in this paper, and that's the approach that the literature trying to think about how we form beliefs usually takes.
Is belief distortion the same as motivated reasoning, or is motivated reasoning one way of achieving belief distortion?
The latter, exactly what you said. So motivated reasoning is one way in which belief distortion may occur.
And how can you motivate your reasoning in order to distort your beliefs, you know, in order to have the beliefs that in some sense can favor you or can allow you to achieve your objectives? What are the mechanisms through which motivated reasoning takes place?
There are typically three mechanisms that authors like Roland Benabou and Jean Tirole have suggested. So one way in which you can motivate your reasoning is you just remain ignorant. You ignore information, and by not knowing, that gives you more vagueness or more uncertainty to form narratives or stories in your mind that then justify a distorted belief. The other mechanism that's what we focus more in our work is that you distort information that comes to you that is a valuable signal. And distorting means, for example, ignoring it. I receive a piece of information, but I do not take it into account. I discount it for some motivated reason. I think, oh, this signal, this piece of information must be, you know, random error. It must not be relevant. There's some reason I can come up with rationalizations for why I shouldn't pay much attention to it. And the last one that is less studied in economics, but more in psychology, is like self-handicapping. So you kind of take actions to impair your ability to have informative signals. So let's say going out for drinks before an exam, then, you know, when you go to the exam, if your performance is not good, you cannot really know why that was. And so you can always engage in that motivated reasoning. Well, I didn't do well because, you know, I went out last night, and not really gain any information about, you know, how smart or how able you were to understand the materials that you're being tested on.
Okay, let me see whether I can remember this. I want to achieve certain beliefs to convince myself or that something is true, or to keep believing that something is true. Number one, I try to avoid any signals that may disabuse me from that notion. Number two, I receive the signals, but then I ignore them, forget them, or give them less weight, or give them a weight that is, you know, different from the optimal Bayesian one. And number three, I put myself in a situation to affect the signal structure, let's say.
Exactly.
That may, the signal is pulled with a lot of noise or something like that, which is what you were saying with, well, if I fail the exam, I don't know that it is because I am not able, or maybe that I was hungover or something like that. This is a, you know, a study that in which you study this type of a mechanisms of motivated reasoning. So you do this in the context of moral behavior. So this is like you have a setting in which there is an advisor, an advisee. The advisor is going to be making a recommendation to the advisee. The interest of both may or may not be aligned because, you know, there are two products that need to be recommended. One of them may be better for the advisee, but maybe the other one is better for the advisor. The advisor receives some type of a commission. So can you describe in this type of settings in which there is this type of moral behavior with recommendations advisors and advisees. What does, prior to the, to your paper, what has the literature shown about the existence of motivated reasoning or belief distortion, specifically in this type of like advising setting?
So previous work has shown that incentives can bias behavior, but they can bias behavior, especially in cases in which the advisors know early about the incentives and then evaluate products or have to provide a recommendation. So previous work has shown that advisors are motivated by incentives, but that they interpret or the effects of incentives are especially strong when advisors can see products or the recommendation task in which they are, already knowing how they are incentivized themselves within that recommendation setting.
Let me rephrase this and see whether I'm understanding it properly and whether you disagree with my interpretation. So let's imagine that I'm the advisor and you are the advisee. I see that product A is better for me, product B is better for you. One view of the world is that I recommend product A just because, you know what, I admit that I'm selfish and immoral. I don't care. I'm going to lie to you, to your face. Not a problem for me. So me recommending product B could, in principle, without any more information, would be compatible, you know, with this view of the world. The second view of the world will be, well, I see that product A is better for me. I'm going to recommend product A for you, even though product B is better for you. But I kind of, you know, hate thinking of myself as a terrible person. So I'm going to convince myself that actually product A is actually better for you. And so that will be the motivated reasoning that you are describing. And now you're saying, in my previous papers, this type of convincing of myself, this belief distortion, this motivated reasoning, is harder for me to do if I learn first what is the product that is best for you and then which is the best for me, rather than the other way around. That's something that you have done in previous work.
Exactly. Yes.
That already, I didn't know about it. That already I find incredible. This is obviously like the starting point of this current paper. You replicate this type of finding, or you use this type of finding like as a building block for the rest of the paper. Could you describe what you call the no choice experiment, which is the experiment in which this thing that we described just now is happening, and that you use as a building block, which you will, you know, put bells and whistles afterwards for what the, actually this paper is about. How does this no-choice experiment work?
So in the no-choice experiment, we have advisors come in, and their task is to recommend, as you were talking about before, either a product A or a product B. Now, the product B can be one of two types, and advisors do not know exactly whether it's a high quality type or a low quality type. So a good product for the advisee or a worse product for the advisee relative to product A. So they come into the experiment, they know, advisors know that they are going to be recommending something to one of these products, A or B, to the advisee. And they know they will receive two pieces of information. One is, oh, here's a signal of quality from product B. So that's information that reveals whether product B is more likely to be high quality than low quality. And then they will also learn whether recommending product A or recommending product B will yield them a commission, an additional payment or bonus incentive. What we vary in the no choice experiment is that some advisors come in and first learn what their incentive is, what product they are incentivized to recommend, either A or B. And then once they have this information of what they are incentivized to recommend, they see the quality information about product B. And so that's a treatment where we call the see the incentive first. So that's what they see first, versus other advisors that come in and are randomly assigned to seeing the quality signal first. So they first will see the quality signal about product B, and then only after learn what they are incentivized to recommend.
I mean, there is not a complete, but a very strong element of symmetry here, right? In that both products can be better for the advisor and both products can be better for the advisee. So now we have kind of like four combinations of A, B, B, A, 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 and B, B, right? So so the first thing to say is that maybe in terms of keeping talking about these type of situations, maybe it's better to just keep referring to them as you do in the paper, of course, as a case of aligned incentives and misaligned incentives, right? Because, you know, AA and BB is kind of, there's no conflict of interest there, right? Whereas with BA and AB, now there is a conflict of interest, but it makes sense to kind of separate, you know, these four categories or group them into two. The second is that you said, oh, receive a signal and all this. So this is actually, the experiment is actually even more complicated than you described it, because there is like, there are balls with dollar values, and then the dollar values can be $2 or $0, and then the urns contain a combination of the... Why do you create all these signals in such a, like, you know, relatively complicated, I mean, complicated way, not from the perspective of actually solving a model, but from the perspective of that now you have to expect that these people are able to do Bayesian updating, because when, you know, I observe a zero ball from the urn, that means that maybe it is more likely that there are more zero balls as opposed to $2 balls, which means maybe it is less likely that the product B is more valuable than the product. Why add this additional level of complexity?
There are several reasons why we do it in this way. So first of all, we want to study belief distortion, and we think one of the mechanisms is the one we talked about earlier, people not paying sufficient attention or discounting signals. So we want to have an environment in which we have a Bayesian benchmark or a very clear model of what a very rational advisor who processes information perfectly would do, and then compare that against the behavior of our actual advisors across treatments and, you know, when there's a conflict of interest and when there's not, depending on when they receive the information. So that's one reason. The other reason is that previous research has also found that in order for people to form this distortion or this distorted beliefs and this motivated reasoning, there needs to be some degree of uncertainty or flexibility or vagueness in the environment. If it's very, very clear that the action that you're taking or that an advisor is taking in their own self-interest is clearly harming the client, and there's no uncertainty about it, then there's very little scope for belief distortion and for forming those narratives in your mind. Then you're one of these types that, you know, you either do it because you care about yourself, or you never do it because it's clear that it's going to harm someone else.
So you're telling me, see, if instead of observing these balls that come from these urns and so on and so forth, I receive a piece of paper that in capital letters underlined said, product A is better for the advisee, then it will be harder for me to ignore that information or something like that.
Correct.
So you're making it easier here.
Exactly.
Right? You're making it easier for belief distortion to appear.
Yes.
So this is fine. Okay, so now let's just focusing again. We're not building anything on top, just up to this point. We're still on the no choice experiment, which, as you described, we were referring to previous work, but never mind. You are telling me if I observe what product is better for me, I am the advisor in this case first, then I am going to be more likely to recommend the product that is better for me to you, as opposed to a situation in which I first observe what is better for you, and then afterwards I observe what is better for me. Why do you think that this happens?
What we think is happening is the attention or the weight given to what is better to the other person is very different when that is first front and center, and that's observed with no other context. The first thing you learn is what is best for someone else. Then you evaluate it and the advisor takes it more into account, pays more attention to that piece of information. Then when this what is better for something else is evaluated through the lens of one's own, of the advisor's own incentives. So what we think, in short, what we think is going on is that that piece of information that gives some signal about what is best for the advisor ends up being discounted and taken less into account and given less attention. This is our interpretation of how the behavior in the experiment arises, and it's consistent with, you know, other evidence we have, but we don't have a direct measure of attention to that signal in terms of metrics of attention that you could think of.
I am not doubting this interpretation. Also, I guess the result is what it is, you know, but I want to remark on how quickly agents are able to allocate or withdraw this type of attention to this piece of evidence. Like if you told me, see, I'm going to give you the first piece of evidence, you know, what is better for you, let's say, and then I'm going to make you read a book, okay, for 7 hours. And then afterwards, I'm going to give you the second piece of information. I could see that, you know, maybe in these 7 hours, I start getting tired or my attention is more malleable, right? But if the two pieces of evidence come within 5 seconds of each other, it is, I would say, quite remarkable that the order, you know, seems to determine so strongly, you know, the whether the recommendation is aligned or misaligned.
I think you're right in saying, look, timing here is really important, right? And you're doing this in a very short period of time. And it seems to, the data reveal strong effects of order, right? And one question that, you know, as researchers, we always have is this, you know, something that we think, you know, we believe in, right? Is this a result? You know, the timing, can it have such striking effects? And it's very much in line with a lot of literature in psychology and with previous work on bargaining, where I don't know if you're familiar, there's the studies on by Linda Babcock, George Lowenstein, and co-authors, where they also vary just within a short experiment whether people in a bargaining situation first learn about the bargaining environment and then learn about their roles. Are they plaintiff or defendant? In varying the order in a similar manner seems to really matter for bargaining impasse down the road. So in some sense, timing seems to be important in similar other contexts, which gives us this, you know, reassurance, right, that more pieces of evidence seem to indicate that this matters. Of course, it is important to think, well, what would happen if there would be more time delay between one piece of information and the other? And this is something that we haven't explored, but definitely would be important to know what the limits and what the strengths of the finding are. Yeah.
Okay. So just briefly, and then we move on to what the paper is about, but can you give us an idea of the results of this no choice experiment? You have said, oh, you know, the incentivized product is advised more when the advisor sees the incentive first, and less when the advisor sees the quality to the advisee first. But how? What are these percentages? What are these numbers, and so on?
Okay. One thing that is important as well is, as you were saying earlier, the cases in which there's a conflict of interest and the cases in which there is no conflict of interest. Right. So. What we see in our experiments is that advisors who first see their incentive recommend the incentivized product 80% of the time, even there if there is a conflict of interest, in the sense that even if that is potentially worse for the client. Now, that percentage that is close to 80% goes down to a little bit above 60%. if we just switch the order in the sense that we tell advisors first what the quality signal is for the product B, the one that has uncertain quality, and only after that, we inform them about their own incentive.
So this 20%
of interest. Yeah.
Sorry. So these 20% were the marginal types who wanted to convince themselves that the incentivized product was the better for the advisee, but they didn't want to convince themselves enough, let's say, right? That in that the order actually moved them from one position to the other. Okay. What about, you said this is when there is a conflict of interest. What happens when there is no conflict of interest?
So when there's no conflict of interest, what we see is that the incentivized product, the product the advisor is incentivized to recommend, is also in the best interest of the client. So you would expect most advisors or all advisors to recommend it. And we see close to 90% of them recommend the incentivized product. And what is more important is, well, does order, whether they see the incentive first or see the quality signal first, matter for advisor's recommendation if there's no conflict? And it doesn't matter, which suggests that it's really important that there is a conflict of interest to engage in this potential self-serving belief distortion that and yields the differences in, let's say, information order than we see when there's a conflict of interest.
So the second part is reassuring, okay, that the order doesn't matter. The first part of what you said makes me wonder, how is it possible that 10% of the advisors fail to recommend a product that is better for the advisee and also better for them? What do you think is going on there?
So there could be some percentage that are not paying attention, but that's, you know, 5% or some small percentage could be people just not paying attention to the materials at all. But what we think is happening is product A and product B are quite different. And some advisors, no matter the signal that they get, they seem to have a preference to recommend product A because product A doesn't have the uncertainty in the quality. They know what they are recommending. With product B, they don't know if the quality is low or high. We do give them a signal, right? It's more likely high than low or vice versa, but there still is throughout the data a preference, no matter the signal, to recommend A.
Okay, so now you have another set of experiments that look exactly like the no choice experiment that we have just discussed, but now there is something on top, which is that you ask the advisors prior to this whether they want to see the incentive first or the quality first. What are your predictions? What do you find there?
So our predictions were that some advisors, so first of all, there's a question of what do advisors prefer? Do they realize that choosing to see the incentive first will potentially give them more flexibility if there's a conflict of interest, and then they will be more likely to recommend the incentivized option? And if they can anticipate this, what are their preferences? And you can imagine two types of advisors. One is the type that knows that they may succumb to the incentive in some way. So they realize, hey, once as advisor, I know my incentive, that may taint the attention or the interpretation I put to quality signals and may be something that leads me to recommend the incentivized product with more likelihood. People who think that that's not the correct moral choice, that care very much about giving the right advice for the client, if they anticipate this, we would expect them to choose to seek quality first to avoid commit what we call moral commitment. If you choose moral commitment, that you're showing concern for the client in the sense that it's less likely that you recommend the incentivized option because there's less scope for this belief distortion.
So this is what you are calling in the title of the paper, limiting cognitive flexibility, correct?
Correct.
That's okay. And the other people?
The other people are people who may recognize that the flexibility is something they want to have in their favor, because they may anyway end up recommending the incentivized product, or maybe it makes them more likely to recommend the incentivized product. But having had cognitive flexibility in a more distorted interpretation of the signal allows them to feel better with themselves at the end of the day by recommending that. Yeah.
So this is, again, what you call in the paper enabling cognitive flexibility. So I want to give myself the option to give all the weight to what matters for me and zero weight or less weight to what matters for the advisee.
Yes.
So I want to, you know, so these are your predictions, and then we are going to discuss the results, et cetera, et cetera. I want to comment at this point that you are asking a lot of out of these agents. You know, you are asking a lot out of, like, the, you know, the ability to strategize. And this is for the following reason. I consider myself, given that I've been an economist for a very long time, and at least from distance, reading about and watching presentations of this type of, like, lab experiments and all this, a relatively sophisticated strategic thinker, relative to the average person in the population, of course. I had no idea that this thing of the order was going on. If you had put me in this situation, I would not have been able to anticipate intuitively that, oh, if I ask to see what is better for me, that is going to make it easier to fool myself and give so much weight to what matters for me relative. You know, like, this anticipation requires, in some sense, having read your previous paper, right? If you are not able to reach it by yourself.
I think as economists, and this is some comment that I've had from another economist, that they said, I never would have thought this mattered. But then I talked to my wife, who's not an economist, and she totally anticipated this happening. And so I'm not sure, you know, maybe it is something in our training and how we think through information that also makes timing less important to us, or that it, yeah, it, we wouldn't expect it to matter as much. But one thing we do, and one thing that is somewhat related, is when you review a paper for a journal, right? So think of yourself as a reviewer who's going to evaluate a paper. There are some journals that will blind you from knowing who the authors are. And nowadays, you can always Google and figure out who the authors are, right? So even if prior to reading the paper, you could see the title, the paper doesn't state the authors, but you have a choice. Do I want to figure out who the authors are prior to reading it? Or do I read the paper as a reviewer? And then, you know, maybe afterwards, I'm curious and I want to figure it out. I want to know who wrote that paper. But I want to first read the paper without knowing who the authors are, to have the most unbiased, objective evaluation of this piece of scientific evidence. And that I think this type of decision of, within the review process, knowing who it is and who it isn't, there's evidence can be biasing, is something we do. I think we are sophisticated enough about to know for ourselves that it would matter.
So you have told me, if the agents are trying to enable the cognitive flexibility, they will want to ask for the incentive first. And if they want to limit it, they will want to ask for the quality or benefit to the advisee first. What do you find? What do these people to whom you offer the choice choose?
So actually, if we just give them the choice, and we have two types of populations, and I can talk about the two groups that we have, we find more or less 50-50, right? So it's slightly above 50% prefer flexibility, so enabling their cognitive flexibility, and then slightly less than 50% prefer to limit it. So we find what you could consider heterogeneity. And we find that in two groups of subjects. One is more like a typical convenience sample that comes and participates in our experiment online. The other is we seek individuals with a professional experience, at least self-reported professional experience in finance and insurance. And what we find is the professional sample, so individuals who work in a bank or who work in insurance companies, they also have kind of a split preference between enabling and limiting their cognitive flexibility, but that preference tends to be more towards limiting it, while the convenience sample tends to prefer to enable the flexibility.
So just to be clear, you are referring now to enabling or limiting, yeah. But at this point, okay, at this point anyway, with everything that you have told me so far, I want to emphasize that there is no evidence that these people are being strategic in any way, right? Like at this point, you know, the fact that, let's say, I know it's not quite like that, but let's say 50% of the population choose one and 50% choose the other, could be perfectly compatible with them thinking, well, I'm not going to bother thinking about what is better for me or this or that. It's too much trouble. I'm going to flip a mental coin. That will perfectly explain your results.
Yes, that could, indifference, them not caring or not thinking about it could explain these results. So that's definitely one concern. And obviously, I think it's also important to emphasize, right? Like now for simplicity, I'm saying, choosing to limit or enable cognitive flexibility.
I understand.
What participants do when they're making these decisions is choosing the order of the signals, right? Yeah. So they choose, do I want to see quality first or the incentive first? And maybe for some people that may be having a little to no difference, but for others, it could be really important. And so one way in which we address this potential explanation that are they indifferent is we make one option costly, right? So if in some treatments we say, hey, you know, if you want to see the incentive first, you're going to forego some payment. Or
this is the core of the paper, in fact.
Yeah. Right?
Making it costly, that's actually the main experiment in the paper.
Well, I think our main experiment is the choice one. There's two conditions which it's free, and then one condition in which it's costly to see the incentive first, and another in which it's costly to actually to see the quality signal first.
Can you describe how that's, sorry, I interrupted you, how that works? What is the additional element that you add, you know, to make it costly to see the incentive first or to see the quality first?
So what we do in the choice experiment when we introduce costs is to say, you're going to choose an information order, whether you want to see the signal first or the quality first. And when seeing the signal first is costly, then they are foregoing an additional payment they would get if they would choose to see the quality signal first. So they are basically choosing, do I want more money or do I really want to pay or give up money to see the signal first or the incentive first? Those are like the costly treatments.
Okay, so let me see whether I understood it. There are three possibilities. So we are going to ask you, do you want to see the incentive first or the quality first? And now there are three possibilities. The first one is the one that you describe earlier, which is just tell us what you want. That's it.
Exactly.
The second case, everything I guess randomly chosen, et cetera, is okay, you tell us whatever you want, but if you tell us that you want to see the incentive first, then when we implement this, instead of paying you a certain commission, when the agent ends up choosing whatever product is better for you, we're going to pay you a lower commission.
Mm-hmm.
The third case is, again, you tell us what you want to see first, but if you tell us that you want to see the quality first, whenever there is a payment that we are going to give you when the agent chooses your incentivized product, we're going to give you, again, a lower payment, correct? These are the three situations and now the two new ones that you are describing.
Correct.
So one thing that I want to emphasize at this point is that this payment seems a little asymmetric. And this is for the following reason. So imagine that I am somebody who has high expectation that the agent is going to choose my incentivized product. Mm? This is because I'm a very selfish person, or I'm really able to distort my beliefs or something like this. No? Now, in that case, for me, that payment that you are asking me, you know, in order to see the order or not, is quite high, right? Because I expect that I'm going to be receiving that commission very often. So therefore, any discount in the commission is high.
You're asking about how we implement the cost about for advisors who choose to see the incentive first or see the quality first, and that is costly, right? And you're saying this is potentially asymmetric because they forego an additional payment. And if that is tied to the commission, whether they recommend the incentivized product or they do not, then for it would have differential incentives.
So we are talking here about dollars. The commission is 15 cents of a dollar. That is, if my favorite product is A and you choose A, I'm going to get 15 cents. But these 15 cents become only 10 cents if I have chosen to see the incentive first. Right? So the commission depends on what you choose. But if I expect that you're going to choose the thing that I want, then in expectation, I'm paying a higher cost than if I expect that you will choose what is better for you, which may or may not coincide with what I want.
I see. Yes. I think previously it wasn't clear how, when I said, you know, how you're describing these treatments is correct. I think what wasn't clear is that, and I'm reviewing the instructions now to see exactly what we told our participants. So a participant who is in, let's say, it's costly to see the incentive first, right? What they are choosing between is, give me the incentive first. That's one option. I want to see that first. The other option is, give me 5 cents, which is a third of the commission, and I'll see the incentive later.
And that eliminates this asymmetry, is what you're
exactly.
saying.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
That's, but thank you for you know, asking and clarifying this, because, you know, it suggests that we, yeah, when we explain it, I think we explain it in a way that it should be clarified. Well,
so what do you find in terms of the stated preferences for seeing one thing first or the other thing first when the choice is costly?
So when it is costly to see the incentive first, so when it is costly to see what may enable cognitive flexibility, around 40% of our participants prefer to still see the incentive first. So there's still a substantial proportion of people who are willing to give up money to see the incentive first. Now, what happens when it's costly to see the quality signal first? In that case, we see around 30% of participants who are willing to pay to see the quality signal first, which would be what would limit their cognitive flexibility.
So let me see whether I understand your interpretation of this. So it was 50%, the people that were choosing the incentive first. Now it goes down to 40%. When they have to pay, but it doesn't go down to zero. Sure. So the fact that it does not go down to zero is evidence, as you interpret it, of the fact that they are willing to pay to have this cognitive flexibility, in this case, to enable this cognitive flexibility. Symmetrically, I guess, 50% more or less wanted to see the quality first. When they have to pay to see the quality first, it goes down to 30, but 30 is not zero. 30 is a number that is higher than zero. So the fact that it does not go down to zero is evidence in this case that they want to limit. They're willing to pay in order to force themselves to not have to distort the beliefs afterwards in order to be selfish afterwards.
Right.
Okay, so this seems good. Now, I'm going to make an argument, and before I make it, let me admit that 40% is very far from zero, and 30% is also very far from zero. But bear with me, okay? Now, one thing that I told you earlier that I was finding very surprising is that in the first, like, no choice experiment and all, even people who have aligned incentives sometimes fail to recommend that product. That is, when product A is better for you and for me, I still 10% of the time recommend product B. Is it possible that this percentage of people are just, you know, like in these lab experiments, I never see any zero, right? Is it possible that there are just people who are not really understanding what is going on? You have asked them to do a lot of work cognitively, really, to get up to this point. And, you know, we said up to this point, we could interpret this as being 50, you know, the flipping of a coin. Maybe there are, you know, 10% of people that realize that this is not a flipping of a coin, and I have to pay, well, I don't want to pay. But the rest are just still flipping the coins without realizing that they are paying to flip these coins.
So you're absolutely right that there's a degree of noise or inattentive participants in any type of lab experiment that requires some type of, you know, decisions that are sophisticated like ours. And what I think we interpret the data as is more, as you were describing it, comparing it to the 50-50 when it's free, in saying how strong is the drop, right? Does it go down to close to zero, or does it remain somewhere between what we find, which is 40 and 30%? And I think one of the important, you know, claims that we should be making is that it's consistent with some participants having a strict preference. But we cannot say that all of the participants that chose to pay have a strict preference. So just is suggestive evidence that there are a lot of people. And given the level of noise that we see in, let's say, the no choice condition in other experiments, it's unlikely that all of these 40% are choosing in, let's say, a random or noisy way, and they don't know why they are choosing to pay for either information or the.
So let me see whether we agree on this. You are making an argument that is quantitative rather than qualitative. Like, if this number was not zero, but was 5%, you wouldn't feel confident in claiming that, oh, these people are paying to limit, you know? Yeah. Maybe with 10% either, I don't know, right? So there is like a, you know, it's a continuum, and you are making the argument, well, actually, this number seems pretty close to 40%. That's the way that you are interpreting, you know, the fact that the drop is not that high.
Yes, that is one way in which we interpret it, for sure. And even if when we see people being willing to pay for one option or the other, you could say there are different reasons, not exactly maybe the reason that you're thinking of. And that's why we look into more types of data and add more things to the experiment to try to understand, is this, you know, the participants really revealing a preference and understanding the potentially distorting effects of seeing the incentives first. So yeah, it's not just one piece of evidence and saying, oh, if we would have found 10%, it's not there. If we would have found 25, that's our boundary. But it's more like, is it this together with other pieces of evidence that paints a consistent picture?
So let's go to this first piece of evidence. So you have a measure of selfishness. We have, already stretched the cognitive limits of our audience. You know, so I think that, you know, if it is okay with you, let's just not describe how this measure of selfishness is created. There is an additional experiment, et cetera, but you create it from somewhere, and now you correlate your results with that measure of selfishness, right? Mm-hmm. That's what is important for here. What do you find?
We find that advisors who are more self-interested in that additional task that is aimed to measure their selfishness are more likely to want to see the incentive first. So advisors who are more self-interested, right? They also want to see their incentive first or earlier.
So I agree with you. I think that this has clearly a flavor of, oh, there are certain people that we can characterize, you know, not, I guess exogenously is not the right word, but somewhere else, okay, through a different measure, a different experiment, et cetera, that are, you know, the one that seem to be moving here in terms of wanting to make a choice or something. And I think that this is good evidence. But I wanted to interrogate you, if you don't mind, about whether selfishness should be predicting levels or changes, okay? Because in principle, you could say, if I'm incredibly selfish, I'm not going to be relying on this like distortion and motivated reasoning. I don't care. I don't really need to pay to see anything first. I know that whether I see one thing first or another, I'm just going to recommend whatever is best for me, right? So you have, in some sense, like an interpretation of this, in that selfishness affects, you know, the marginal cost of deceiving yourself, as opposed to, you know, another possible interpretation could be just the willingness, you know, to do what's best for you without needing to deceive yourself.
I think that you can think of selfishness or people who end up taking, like, let's say, a selfish decision in two ways. So one is exactly what you're saying. I have no moral costs. I just go for my own self-interest. I came to this experiment to make money, and that's what I'm going to do. Maximize the money that ends in my pocket in the end of the day or this time. And there are some people who do this and feel okay with themselves. But there are some people who, if given the scope, they would rather take and receive the same outcome without feeling it was the selfish thing to do. And that can kind of explain this relationship, I think, that we see in the data. But of course, if all types would not care, then I agree with also your alternative that, you know, if I'm selfish, I'm just selfish and I'll just go with whatever maximizes my payoff and minimizes the costs.
What is the second piece of evidence that you were referring to? The second additional experiment that provides an interpretation, that helps with interpretation?
Yeah, so what we also ask our participants in a different set of data collection is whether in an additional task, they want to not know their incentives at all, right? So they are basically what is called blinding in the literature. They're blinding themselves to the incentives. And so they are choosing, we ask them to choose, do you want to make the recommendation knowing more about product B, but not knowing whether you're going to get the incentive or the commission at the end prior to recommend, you know, to providing what's best for the client. And we see that, you know, those advisors who prefer to see quality first, they also are more likely to prefer to blind themselves and not know about their incentives altogether prior to recommending the product. A little bit like a reviewer blinding himself from knowing the authors. That's kind of the idea that we think about in this setting.
So this seems great, like a very strong additional evidence in favor. I am wondering then, well, why not reach the message from the paper, maybe exclusively from this blinding experiment? Because you could, in principle, without this, you know, like flexibility of one type or another, you could just say, imagine that I want to show that people are willing to pay to limit their cognitive flexibility. Well, one way to limit the cognitive flexibility to the extreme is to blind yourself, right? That is the maximum amount of limiting that you can do. If people are willing to pay, that's kind of also, you know, like prima facie, right? The evidence of the main message of the paper, at least half of it.
I do agree that it's interesting and an important piece of the paper. What we think makes the other part striking is that we're, you know, when you blind yourself, you're making recommendation decisions without knowing the incentives. And if you do not blind yourself, then you do know your incentives. So that makes the advisor differently informed at the time at which they provide a recommendation. And so that obviously biases recommendations and subsequent behavior. What is nice about the first set of experiments is that advisors, prior when they arrive to the stage of what do you recommend, A or B, in all of the cases, they have received both pieces of information. They know their incentive and they know the quality signal. We've just varied the order. That kind of, when we're looking at recommendation decisions, makes that analysis and those interpretations also more compelling.
So, you know, with every lab experiment, a question typically here is the extent to which the mechanisms that you document, you know, in your setting can extend to other settings. So you discuss in the paper, you know, issues maybe like a higher stakes or reputation concerns, more experienced advisors and so on. But one thing that I wanted to discuss is the empirical relevance of, you know, the having the ability to order the information in a particular way, specifically with respect to what the organization should do. Like, it seems to me that any organization, any type of maybe policymaker, you know, to the extent that we are valuing the utility of the advisee more than the one of the advisor, which I guess is, you know, typically the assumption, yes, there is no scope for giving any type of discretion, right? Like, they should see the quality first and that's it, right? There is no, you know, I think that, however, one way of interpreting the message of this paper is, well, even if you let them decide, there will be still a significant proportion that will still make the right choice. Am I wrong in getting this broad message from the paper?
No, I think that is one of the main messages that we want to put forward, right? Like, even if the individual, the employee or the advisor is able to decide by themselves, there will be a significant portion of people who acknowledge and say, hey, I don't want to be biased and want to be moral, and I choose the order that is going to decrease that likelihood of being self-interested or biased.
Okay, wonderful, Marta. Thank you for coming to the podcast.
Thank you.
Please visit our website, thevisiblehand.uk, for any past or future episodes that you may enjoy. Introductory music and logo by Tania Blanes-Iso, episode produced by Anderson Tan.